Hello, welcome to Outdoors In. I'm John Burns, and we've got a very special guest on today's show. We've got Mick Fowler, who is, I have to say, is one of the outstanding mountaineers of his generation. He's won the Golden Piton, it says here, of Pilon d'Or, which is essentially like, I suppose, the Oscar of mountaineering on no less than three occasions. And I'm going to ask him about one of his notable climbs is the Prow of Shiva, which I think is a fantastic name for a climb. And he's also an author. He's written three books, No Easy Way, On Thin Ice, and Vertical Pleasure. So a pretty distinguished guest, I think. And that's flattered him enough. hello, Mick, how are you doing?
I'm fully flattered, John. Yeah.
Good. Well, that's what we aim to please, you know. And so you live in Derbyshire now, is that right?
That's right, yes. I moved up from London. I was from London originally.
Yeah.
Moved up to South Derbyshire way back in 1993 now. Spent 25 years in South Derbyshire and then retired a couple of years ago and moved up to Matlock. And so we're now in Matlock, just above High Tor. Yeah,
right. Okay, so it's a bit of a contrast from London, I should imagine.
Maximum contrast. Yes. Yeah, much better.
So obviously, this virus has put a bit of a damper on everything for everybody. But I just wondered, what were your plans this year? Have you had to cancel quite a bit?
No, I haven't. No, I was out in Kenya, climbing on Mount Kenya in January.
All right. Yeah.
Then I was back for climbing in the Scottish winter season. What it did interrupt was my Scottish winter season.
Yeah.
I was going up a few times and introducing my son to the joys of Scottish winter climbing, and that was brought to a sort of grinding halt by the coronavirus.
But yeah, we just
in the country.
We just started to get half decent conditions, and it sort of. Then the virus came in, didn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So, just as you say, it was beginning to look really good. And I was planning to go up, but then it gradually became clear that that would be sort of socially unacceptable.
Yeah.
And then the government stepped in and made it sort of legally unacceptable, if you like.
Yeah.
So we've been locked down since then. But, I can't complain that we're very fortunate here being locked down in Matlock, whereas beautiful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. Yeah.
And we can get out.
Yeah.
And it's a world apart from being locked down in a town.
Oh, yeah.
Stuck
in
a flat, which must be absolutely awful.
Oh, God. If you're stuck in a flat in London or somewhere, it must be pretty difficult. Yeah. We're living through pretty dark times, really, by all means. But hopefully one time we'll look back on this and we won't sort of unbelieve how we got through it, you know.
And well, yes, although I fear it's going to have a pretty marked effect on all of us for quite a long time to come.
And you were saying that you've been taking your son climbing. Am I right in thinking that you got into climbing because your father took you to the Alps? Is that right?
Basically, yes. I mean, my father, he was widowed when I was three.
Oh, right.
He was always keen on the outdoors. And so he would take me hill walking, really. And it was while we were hill walking that I saw people rock climbing. And he had done a little bit of rock climbing. And so he introduced me to sort of scrambling, rock climbing, easy climbs. So we very occasionally climbed on the sandstone outcrops down to the south of London, around Tunbridge Wells.
Well, what are they called?
Harrison's Rocks is the
Harrison's Rocks,
one.
Yeah, I've heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the most famous one.
Yeah.
And I started going there initially with him.
Right.
And a couple of his friends. And then gradually I started to go under my own steam. So I would go out and the London disco scene on a Saturday night, and then I'd be hung over on the first train down to Harrison's Rocks on the Sunday morning. There that I met like-minded people and really started to get very keen on the climbing.
Right now, very famously, you used to do marathon drives from London up to Scotland overnight. What was that like?
Oh yeah. Well, I think, to be honest, not as bad as you would think. I mean, there was a really healthy climbing scene in London at that time, a really vibrant community. And we used to meet on a Wednesday night in a pub called The Globe, decide who was going to fill which car at the weekend and egg each other on. And because we were going up every weekend, and you know, we had a very good handle on what the conditions were like. In those days, there were quite a lot of very prominent unclimbed ice streaks in Scotland.
And so I suppose there were. This is the 70s, yeah? 80s?
Yeah, 70s, 80s, early
90s. Right, yeah.
And so there was lots of inspiring unclimbed lines. And with four people in the car, even that going up to places like Torridon, you know, which is about 620, 630 miles from London, I think.
Wow. Yeah,
it was only just over 150 miles per driver. So we would take turns in driving.
Right.
No, it would take 10 hours or so. And admittedly, we'd get there, you know, well, sometimes we would get there just in time to get out of the car and start walking up to the crag.
Right, it's quite remarkable. I'm about the same age as you, and we used to drive up to Scotland as well. And I had an old Marina, and you've got what kind of car did you used to drive mostly then?
Well, we started off with my minivans. an awful lot of minivans, but by the time we were going up for the weekend, I remember going up in a Ford Fiesta.
Oh, luxury.
Squeezing four people and four people's gear into the Fiesta. But most of the time, we graduated up to cars like Vauxhall Cavalier.
Oh, right. Okay. I remember cars in those days. They used to rattle and sort of break down quite a bit. I don't know. One occasion, me and my mates were driving, doing the same thing, really, driving up to Torridon. And for some reason, we went into a skid. We managed to wrap the car around the petrol station wall, and that kind of put the end to that weekend. You know, did anything like that happen to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Never failed to get there, as this evening. Yeah, and we never actually had a breakdown.
Good Lord!
I remember once we. And we were overtaking on the motorway. Didn't realise that it was narrowing down to two lanes, and drove over lots of bollards, which didn't do the car very much good at all. But we still managed to carry on driving up to Scotland and get there. one time, the most memorable time, I suppose, was when John English had a Volkswagen Sirocco. You remember those?
Oh yeah.
And he lost it on the road near Achnasheen.
Okay.
And John is a remarkably calm sort of person. And I just remember him in the driving seat turning around and saying, "Sorry, chaps." And we just left the road and we careered down a slope and ended up in the loch.
Oh,
and eventually we got a very drunk chap who was in the pub, but had the keys to a JCB, which he managed to drive down the bank and hook up the car and pull the car back on the road. And we drove it back to London. It was amazing. It was a very good advert for Volkswagen Siroccos.
Certainly is, yeah. So, to be quite honest, it sounds to me as though the most dangerous thing you've ever done in your climbing career was probably to drive to Scotland.
Yeah, you're probably right.
I would imagine it.
Tired drivers on the way back, yeah.
Definitely. I think if you know most climbers at one point have a catalogue of car crashes, usually in various places across the world. I think because obviously you know, if you're climbing, it involves a lot of travel. There's no two ways about it.
Well, it does. And only once have I had a nasty crash on the way back from the Alps.
Right.
Back in 31st of July 1978.
That's all right. I remember it. Okay. You managed to climb out of that one by the sound of it, though, did you?
Well, we're on the way back at the time, but we did end up in hospital for a bit.
Oh, right. Oh, good. Yeah.
Poor minivan got written off, abandoned in France.
Oh, yeah. Well,
that was the only time, though.
Well, it's pretty good. If you've done all that driving, you might only have one, you know? I was really impressed. Obviously, I mean, you've got an amazing career behind you. Most of the time, you were known as the climbing tax man, weren't you? So most of the time, you were actually working as well. Is that right?
Oh yes, yeah. I worked full time for the tax office, from 1977 right the way through. I did drop to part-time eventually, but I finally retired in January 2017.
So I was not that long. I mean, to have amassed the climbs that you've done essentially in your holidays is pretty good going, really.
Well, it was an awful lot of time juggling. Yeah, that was the most difficult thing, really, to juggle time between family, work, and climbing, which it's a challenging thing to do for what was 39 years that I worked for the tax office.
Wow.
but to be fair to them, the tax office were very flexible, the reasons that I stayed with them.
I see. Okay. So they were pretty accommodating.
When it came to, taking long holidays to go to the Himalayas, a lot of employers would not really have stood for that. You can imagine the way it went to begin with. It was, well, this is a trip of a lifetime, please, I really must book this annual holiday to go.
Yeah.
The trip of a lifetime seemed to be happening every year.
You've had a lot of trips a lifetime. Yeah, exactly.
In an organization like the tax office, as long as I gave enough notice and organized cover for while I was away, those above me were pretty content with what was happening. And so that worked for me. And that was really the main reason that I stayed with them for an amazing 39 years.
That's a long time, isn't it? That's something really probably that our generation only experience these days, because getting a job for that length of time now is it would be almost unthinkable, you know.
And maybe within the government it's still much.
Maybe it happens in the government. Yeah. So of all the mountaineering, what do you regard as your greatest achievement, do you think?
Oh, gosh.
I just start with the hard questions first.
I don't think I really look at it like that, to be absolutely honest.
Right.
I look on it that I've been lucky enough to, have some fantastic times in all sorts of different climbing, from technical rock climbing when I started, putting up new technical climbs, if you like, throughout the UK.
Yeah.
And being lucky enough to be climbing at a time when you didn't have to be an obsessed athlete who was training all the time to do the hardest routes. So, to climb E5 or perhaps sometimes even E6 routes back in the late 1970s, that was a sort of top standard at the time. Mm-hmm. And there were not that many people who were climbing those routes, and to climb them sort of on site in places like Scotland, doing routes such as Stairway to Heaven, for example, on Skye, mm-hmm. or Big John up on the sea cliffs of Orkney on Hoy, were brilliant things to do. And then there's the next phase for winter climbing. I've already mentioned that I was so fortunate that there were wonderful unclimbed ice streak type lines in Scotland, and gullies, in fact, things like Gully of the Gods up in Applecross. So they were wonderful days, I think, going up to Scotland from London and managing to climb unclimbed ice routes or winter routes in Scotland. It was a really great feeling to get back to work on a Monday morning and feel you'd done something. It felt constructive somehow. I'm not quite sure. Rock and ice at the weekend, but it did.
Oh, it's quite an achievement, and a very different life, isn't it? I always felt with that sort of, when I was climbing, like that, you came back from almost coming back from like a different world. Do you know what I mean?
Very much so. Yeah, I remember walking through the streets of London, sort of on the way to work, feeling the sort of early April sunshine on me, and it was really quite warm. And thinking, goodness me, you know, this was on a Monday morning, and thinking back and thinking, God, this time yesterday, you know, I was climbing a mega ice route in Scotland.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it? And most of the people around you would never have experienced something like that.
Well, no, and yeah, you get into work on a Monday morning and they'd say, do you have a good weekend? And I didn't really share with the people at work what I've been up to at the weekend. And I'd just say, oh, yeah, good weekend. You too. And they'd say, oh, yes. You know, we had a good day out shopping on Saturday. So, oh, good.
Well, cut just the grass or whatever.
Getting with my work. But yeah, I was very lucky to, you know.
But it was more, from what you're saying, it was kind of like a lifestyle, was it, that attracted you, rather than having one particular goal?
I missed that, John.
Was it the lifestyle that really attracted you, that rather than having one particular goal you wanted to achieve?
The lifestyle increasingly did attract me, yes, because, you know, I made lots of friends, and lots of friends throughout the country as well. And that, amazingly, that dovetailed quite well with working for the tax office, because one of my early jobs in the tax office was going around the country looking at staffing levels in the various local tax offices.
Okay.
They had a network of local tax offices in those days. And so what would happen was I would arrange to stay with somebody who went climbing in each town that I went to. Okay. And I went to nearly every big town in the country.
Oh, right. So you must have had a real network then.
So it was a great network of friends that I met and went climbing with, because, you know, they would go out in the evenings. And so I'd meet the sort of local climbing groups and be introduced to the local climbs in the evenings. And then I'd go back to London on a Friday afternoon and pick up my climbing team for the weekend and then drive off again for the weekend. I remember my girlfriend at the time being very upset, with the benefit of hindsight, perhaps justifiably, that I hadn't seen her all week. I'd been working in Sunderland and climbing up there in the evenings. And I drove back to London on the Friday afternoon, said hello to her, and then turned the car around and drove back up to Scotland for the weekend. And she wasn't very impressed.
She did recognise you when she saw you, didn't she, now and again?
Yeah, she left me eventually, yeah.
Oh, right. And it was, well, okay, well, if you look back, what would you like to, are there any regrets, anything you really would like to have done that you think you perhaps won't do now, or what do you think?
Not really. I mean, I've got a box file of objectives and things that I'd like to do.
So you've still got quite a lot of ambitions left, really, by the sound of it, then. You know, you're by no means retired from climbing.
Oh, no. I think, you know, technically, I'm not as good as I used to be.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean that I don't have the same desire to go climbing. So I'm still as keen on climbing, particularly the mountaineering and the winter climbing.
Yes, yeah. That's great. When you get to my, well, I think the wheels fell off my pram quite a while ago, to be quite honest. But I'm still doing the odd thing here and there, you know.
I mean, I was out in the Himalayas twice last year.
Right.
And then, you know, coronavirus permitting, we'll be back again in September.
Great.
So there's still lots to be done.
Yeah. And did you do any sort of work in the sort of mountaineering field, about equipment or anything like that? Are you involved in the design stage of stuff at all?
Yes. I've got a long-standing relationship now with Berghaus. I've been with them since 2008. Helping them in an ambassador role, and also in helping design their equipment, giving feedback, and working with them on sort of all aspects of their work and their products.
Well, it's basically sort of like tuning into your expertise. Is that right?
Well, that's right. Yes.
Oh, okay. And in terms of your writing, I mean, I don't know how you've done all this. You've managed to get all these climbs written, working full time, and you also managed to write three books. no easy way onto an ice and vertical pleasure. And what about your literary ambitions? Do you think you've got another book left, or is that it?
I always thought that would be it. Some people have contacted me and suggesting that I should write another one. But I think I'll wait and see how the next Himalayan trips pan out and see whether I've got the enthusiasm to write it. I think my previous books were largely I'd always written articles.
I see.
On my climbs, and the books effectively drew together the articles that I'd written with a few extra anecdotes poked in.
Right, okay.
So what's being suggested to me now is that I do a book, which is, I don't know if you know, but I was diagnosed with cancer a couple of years ago and had to have a big operation to have various bits cut out.
Right, I did hear that, yeah.
One of the things that I'm doing now is working with, I'm just about to work with Braun, the medical equipment suppliers, as an ambassador for them. So that's a sort of another thing to keep me occupied. And what the possibility is that I will write a book about the cancer side of things, the recovery side.
Your experience, yeah.
If that leads through to some future Himalayan successes, then that might be the spur for me to write the book. But I think if it doesn't lead to any successes, then I'm not quite sure that I will have the enthusiasm to write. I'm much more an enthusiastic climber than I am an enthusiastic writer.
Yeah, I mean, I think, one of the things about writing, as you know, there's a lot of sitting indoors staring at screens, and you think, well, I could be doing something better than this sometimes, don't you?
Yeah, and you've got to feel, with me at least, that what I'm writing is maybe of interest to some people. And if I just feel that I'm going to end up waffling because I haven't got enough material, then I think I'd find trouble.
I can't imagine you waffling, sir. I'm sure that you know. So you always got a hell of a lot of drive, and sounds to me as though you've got more. There's a lot more to Mick Fowler to come, by the sound of it, to be honest.
Well, yeah, I think the trouble is that there are so many things to squeeze into life that I'm not quite sure that I've got the time to do the writing, if you like.
Yes, sure, that'll come too.
Lockdown, you know, I'm finding that there's so many things that I need to do at home or want to do that I'm not quite sure that I'll have got them all done by the time we're released to go climbing again.
I see, fair enough. I mean, this must be the most you've seen of your family for quite some time, isn't it?
Nikki, my wife, I mean, she's retired as well, so we've been forced to spend time together, if you like, since and we were out climbing together in January, which was fantastic. So no, that's not a problem. That's been fine. No, she has the pleasure of seeing me quite a lot.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, look, it's been great talking to you, and I really hope. For everybody that we would, when this lockdown's behind us, that you get out and you get out to enjoy the climbing that you've always done. I'm sure it sounds to me as though that you've got a lot more to do, you know?
I hope so. and you, John, you're in the right place for it all. So
I certainly am. Okay, Mick Fowler, thanks very much for coming on. It's been really a pleasure talking to you.